There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The tension was palpable, thick, when President Obama met Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu at the White House on Thursday. And it wasn't much better when he spoke before the conservative pro-Israel group AIPAC yesterday. The Arab Spring is changing Israel's neighborhood. Everyone's assessing exactly what it means. Those assessments don't always line up. This hour on Point, the U.S. and Arab-Israeli peace in the era of the Arab Spring. You can join the conversation. Does a democratizing Arab world make a peace deal between Palestinians and Israelis more important than ever? How should the U.S. balance a commitment to Arab democracy and its commitment to Israel? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, and now a professor in Middle Eastern Policy Studies at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Daniel Kurtzer, Ambassador Kurtzer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Michelle Dunn, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and editor of the online journal Arab Reform Bulletin. She's worked on Mideast affairs at the State Department and White House, at the National Security Council, and overseas at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo and the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem. Michelle Dunn, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Daniel Kurtzer, Mr. Ambassador, here's the President saying in his speech last week, at a time when the people of the Middle East and North Africa are casting off the burdens of the past, the drive for a lasting peace that ends the conflict and resolves all claims, Arab-Israeli, is more urgent than ever. How do the changes in the Arab world of these recent months change the strategic framework and perhaps the urgency of peace in the Middle East?
One of the arguments, Tom, that has been marshaled against the peace process among some in Israel has been how do you make peace with dictators and unstable neighbors? And the argument has been that until there is a wave of democracy in the region, Israel will always be insecure. So what the president is trying to tap into now is the idea that overall security for Israel will actually be enhanced if this Arab Spring can really become translated into a serious democratization among Israel's neighbors. Now, the president is also very mindful of the fact that the democratization process is uneven, it's going to take time, and it's not a certainty. And so there has to be a certain amount of care and caution that goes into any kind of a peace process involving real security and real territorial issues. But the president's bottom line is this is a moment in which to test the proposition that peace not only can be achieved, but that it also can, in a sense, catalyze what is already the beginning of this Arab Spring in a manner that will help Israel's security over the long term.
Michelle Dunn, it may have been dictators for these many years, but those were dictators in any number of countries who had explicit or implicit kind of deals around the status quo. If democracy is rising and the president says supporting those American values are now a top priority of the United States, does that raise the pressure or the stakes around a peace agreement, Michelle?
Well, what I think raises the stakes is that there's a mood in the Arab world now of people rejecting things that were long unacceptable to them, whether it's authoritarian regimes, human rights abuses, or indeed the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And I don't think this mood is going to is going to leave the Palestinians behind, so to speak. I think the Palestinians are themselves susceptible to this mood, that is now time to become more active and to try new strategies. And so I think what's going to be happening is we're going to see a series of initiatives, some of them planned, some of them spontaneous, from the Palestinians that are going to change the equation. A couple of them have already happened. One of them was the Fatah-Hamas reconciliation, and another one were these demonstrations we saw a couple of weeks ago, large but peaceful demonstrations, but doing things that Palestinians haven't done before, like refugees actually trying to cross the border from Syria and from Lebanon. These things are going to change the equation in the Israeli-Arab arena and are going to make it more difficult for the United States to neglect this arena.
Ambassador Kircher, is that what the president's responding to when he talks about a new urgency here? Those images, what, eight or nine days ago now, Palestinians coming across barbed wire borders from Syria, Lebanon, the West Bank, Gaza, and Israeli soldiers shooting and ultimately killing any number of them. I mean, if we see that kind of movement, a sort of echo of Tahrir Square on Israel's borders, does that put Israel in new territory?
Well, I think the president is not only responding to that, but also looking ahead. There is great concern about what will happen in September if there is no progress in the peace process and the Palestinians decide to take their case to the United Nations. Very interestingly, President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority wrote an op-ed last week in which he kind of told people what his game plan was. He said the idea of moving to a unilateral declaration of statehood was not so much a political act as it was to change the legal nature of the dispute resolution process. In other words, once Palestine is a state, he said, a state with disputed territory, it could go to forums such as the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, and the United Nations in order to try to isolate Israel. This is a similar doomsday scenario to the one that Michel Dunn was indicating with respect to nonviolent protest on the part of Palestinians. And I think the president is both responding to these but also trying to head off a train wreck.
Well, a train wreck is exactly the phrase that an Israeli official used to describe what's coming in September. The United States, it appears, could be a little bit lonely opposing statehood for Israel. I mean, the reports I'm seeing, they may indeed find that in the General Assembly if that push ends up there. What then, Ambassador?
Well, I think we would be isolated. There's a question of how Europe would vote, so it could be 185-2, or it could be 160-2 with a lot of abstentions. But the fact is that we would be seriously outvoted by a majority that wants to make a political statement. Now, we would
then it goes to the Security Council. Or,
I was just going to say, it goes to the Security Council for formal membership, and we could veto at that point. But it becomes harder and harder to exercise that veto against such a massive majority within the international system. I think we would do it, but the president doesn't want to have to do it and wants to see a process of peacemaking take place or at least start now that would head off this possibility.
But Michel, the pushback from the Prime Minister Netanyahu has been pretty stiff. If the United States ends up in a situation this fall, which seems entirely possible, where you get this vote declaring a statehood for Palestine, the Palestinians, the U.S. is the veto in Security Council. I mean, as the kind of as the American answer to the Arab Spring, how does that position the United States with these new movements?
Well, as Ambassador Kircher said, that really puts the United States in a very uncomfortable position. And I think what we're seeing here is a lot of tension in the U.S.-Israeli relationship because of this, a lot of tension between Obama and Netanyahu. I think President Obama feels that Netanyahu is simply not helping him out in dealing with this situation, that Netanyahu hasn't really produced any productive initiatives or anything that would help help Obama be able to say to the Palestinians, look, don't go the UN recognition route because we have something else to offer you. We have a feasible negotiating situation for you. He's not able to say that credibly. And so this really, the focus right now is on the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Obviously, there's been a lot of focus on that this week with President Obama's two speeches and Netanyahu's visit here in Washington. And that's been an unhappy story throughout Obama's presidency. I think that President Obama, I mean, it's understandable that it's difficult for him to deal with a prime minister of Israel and a government that, frankly, is not set up to reach a negotiated agreement with the Palestinians. They're not all that interested in it, and certainly not interested in doing it on terms that would be acceptable to the Palestinians. But at the same time, I think President Obama has not yet really formed a solid relationship with the Israeli people and gotten their sort of trust. He's not been able to persuade the Israeli people and the political scene more broadly of where they need to go and the compromises they need to make for peace.
Daniel Kurtzer, in the pushback that we've seen from Prime Minister Netanyahu, even as Israeli officials are quoted calling this what's coming in this fall at the UN maybe a train wreck, does the Prime Minister not believe that the environment has changed in the Arab world? Does he not believe that Israel maybe needs to change or its negotiating posture in response to that?
The discussion in Israel since late January and when events started in Tunisia and then Egypt has been very illuminating. On the one hand, you've had figures both from the left and the right, including Nathan Sharansky, the former Soviet dissident, who has argued quite eloquently that Israel needs to support democracy among its neighbors. On the other hand, you've had elements, especially from the Israeli right, who are extraordinarily skeptical about this Arab Spring, and they believe that all that's going to happen is that dictators with whom Israel had been comfortable will give way to oppositionists who would like to see the Israel relationships get worse. For example, Islamists in Egypt who want to see the peace treaty brought to a referendum, or elements of the left in Egypt who have been very unhappy with Egypt's peaceful relationship with Israel. So they're nervous about this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the United States, Israel, and Mideast peace in the era of the Arab Spring. My guests are Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and to Egypt, joins us today from Princeton, New Jersey. Michelle Dunn is with us from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, editor of the online journal Arab Reform Bulletin, joins us from Washington. You can join us as well. What do you think? Is this Arab Spring changing the fundamental equation in this region? Will Arab democracies create a starker choice for the United States? And if Israel can't negotiate a settlement with the Palestinians, is the U.S. left on the wrong side of Arab democracy? What did you make of President Obama's push in the last week, of Prime Minister Netanyahu's push back? Let's hear some of that for just a moment. This is the president in his big speech on the Arab world, North Africa, the Middle East, on Thursday, talking about threats and the promise of big changes in that world, making clear that democracy in the Arab world, he said, is in the U.S. interest.
We face a historic opportunity. We have the chance to show that America values the dignity of the street vendor in Tunisia more than the raw power of the dictator. There must be no doubt that the United States of America welcomes change that advances self-determination and opportunity. Yes, there will be perils that accompany this moment of promise. But after decades of accepting the world as it is in the region, we have a chance to pursue the world as it should be.
As it should be. And then in that speech, he spoke for just a couple of minutes to Israel, the Palestinians, and here his repeated line about 1967 boundaries.
We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their full potential in a sovereign and contiguous state.
Those lines, even before the speech was given, found a furious response from the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. This weekend, the president was before AIPAC in Washington, the big pro-Israel lobby group there, pushing again on the theme of a reshaped region.
A new generation of Arabs is reshaping the region. A just and lasting peace can no longer be forged with one or two Arab leaders. Going forward, millions of Arab citizens have to see that peace is possible for that peace to be sustained. And just as the context has changed in the Middle East, so too has it been changing in the international community over the last several years. There's a reason why the Palestinians are pursuing their interests at the United Nations.
President Obama in several settings there with remarks that have everybody paying attention. Daniel Kurtzer, Michelle Dunn, let's listen just a little bit of Prime Minister Netanyahu in his response. Here he is in the Oval Office on Friday, insisting to reporters during that photo session that, of course, he too wants peace, but he sees a very different reality.
Israel wants peace. I want peace. What we all want is a peace that will be genuine, that will hold, that will endure. And I think that we both agree that a peace based on illusions will crash eventually on the rocks of Middle Eastern reality, and that the only peace that will endure is one that is based on reality, on unshakable facts.
Peace based on illusion, that kind of in the face of the President of the United States and his all of his comments of the week. And then this from the Israeli Prime Minister on those 1967 lines.
While Israel is prepared to make generous compromises for peace, it cannot go back to the 1967 lines.
Michelle Dunn, can we go to those lines for a moment? Because the president was at pains over the weekend before AIPAC to say, look, it's 1967 lines with swaps. And he said, this isn't really new. This has been at the heart of negotiations for years and years now. Why such a furor over this remark about the 67 lines now? And is President Obama, Michelle, proposing something new here or not?
President Obama didn't really propose something new, but what he did was take something that had been on the table, this idea that the starting point for talks should be the 67 boundaries, but that there could be agreed upon swaps. That had been on the table as a kind of negotiating position. President Clinton had used that, more than 10 years ago. Even the previous Israeli government was willing to have talks on that basis. But I think until President Obama said it right now, it wasn't explicitly declared U.S. policy that that's what should happen. And that's one of the reasons why Netanyahu responded so strongly. Now, Netanyahu might have had his own reasons. I mean, it serves his interests within Israel and shoring up his political right wing to be seen as very tough with the American president and not accepting, any compromises that he might be proposing. But this is not a radical departure. This is something that has been on the table and has been talked about. But it shows Obama moving in the direction of fleshing out the U.S. position of what the solution to this conflict should be.
Ambassador Kurtzer, how do you see the furor over these remarks by the president? I'm looking here at a big ad that was in a lot of Israeli newspapers last week and in the New York Times a couple of days ago, signed by lots of Israelis, many former military and high-ranking, all kinds of positions in Israeli society, saying, recognize a Palestinian state based on the 67 borders. It's vital for Israel's existence. And then lots and lots of signatures from Israelis here. Why such a furor over this when the president said it?
Tom, the spotlight happens to be on the president's comments, but in fact there are six or seven sideshows that are equally important, and I think Michelle referred to a couple of them. First of all, Netanyahu has seemed to be far more attached to his coalition than to the idea of an uncertain peace process. And even before he got on the airplane to come to Washington, he felt compelled to criticize the president's speech before he even had a chance to talk to the president about it. And that was strictly for domestic politics. Secondly, the two leaders just don't get along. They don't like each other and they don't trust each other. This goes back now 2 years since President Obama articulated the idea of a settlements freeze as a precondition for negotiations. I think third, it reflects a great deal of distrust on the part of Netanyahu and his coalition partners for Palestinians, particularly after the reconciliation agreement, and a kind of concern that if they don't set the defensive perimeter far enough away from negotiations, they're going to be suckered into negotiations that will turn out to be very, very bad for them. After all, they could be negotiating in this period with a government that's not only composed of Fatah, headed by Mahmoud Abbas, but also including Hamas. And Netanyahu, like many of his predecessors, are afraid of that slippery slope.
The president pushing back on the Hamas front in his Thursday speech and over the weekend again as well. But let me ask you about your observation that a lot of the Israeli right in power with Prime Minister Netanyahu is very skeptical about the Arab Spring overall. And the, you know, I think you were saying before the break, might be more comfortable dealing with dictators they could do deals with than with democracy. Now the president of the United States has thrown his lot with those democracies very prominently, comparing what's going on in the Arab world to the American Revolution itself back in the 18th century. Does that put the United States on a collision course with Israel, Ambassador?
Well, it shouldn't. You know, Tom, I just came back from Egypt. I was there for about a week, and it is a very exciting time. There's a really a sense of almost a town hall type situation developing where every day there are 15 or 20 gatherings around Cairo, people thinking how to organize political parties and how to get themselves ready for an election. But at the same time, there's a great deal of uncertainty about the foreign policy views, the national security views of many of the people who are also espousing democracy. As I mentioned earlier, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is likely to do fairly well in the upcoming elections. The projections are anywhere from 20 to 35 or 40%. The Muslim Brotherhood has said that it wants a national referendum on peace with Israel. It understands that it can't simply abrogate the treaty, but it's hoping that a national referendum will show the next Egyptian government that they don't want that treaty. Parties on the left that are emerging are very hostile to Israel, largely because of their concern over Palestinian issues. So the Israelis look at this and they say, hey, wait a minute, democracy is wonderful, except it may bring into power those who will bring this region back to a period of confrontation. Now, I don't really believe that, but one has to have a great deal of faith that over time, a democracy will bring forth moderation. And that time is, I think, the issue that's of greatest concern on the Israeli side.
I want to look at that issue. That seems like the real bottom line. We've got lots of listeners calling in. Ambassador Kurtz or Michelle Dunn, please stand by. Let me bring in Barry here from Nashville, Tennessee. Barry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I'd like to start backwards. First of all, I think Netanyahu is completely right. He's absolutely correct. In 1967, there was not a Palestinian entity. So how could they have any sort of rights to the land? All right? The PLO started. The media gave this entity of displaced workers in Israel the name Palestinian, that the land of Palestine is biblical. It's not an Arab name, and how could you go back to 1967 when they were not an entity at the time?
Well, I mean, they were human beings living in that area, and and they're still there on the other side of a lot of defensive positions now. So what do you do now, Barry?
Well, the thing about it is they were not Palestinians, though.
And well, let's not quibble over that. They live there. Call it what you want.
Look, they've been to the United Nations three times. They've already changed their stance with what their entity is three times already.
Barry, does the Arab Spring change the situation? Does it put the United States in a tough situation if it's supporting democracies that may be more strongly in support of those Palestinians?
Well, let me tell you one thing. Now, to go back, these new emerging democracies in the Middle East, take India and Pakistan. It took 50 years for them to come to where they are right now. It's going to take longer for these emerging democracies to stand on their feet for a simple reason, that their law is not the British law like they have in India and Pakistan. It's the courts say Islamic court of law. It does not give you don't have a democratic law.
So Barry, as an American, would you rather see dictatorships there?
No, I would not. But I'm not going to be romantic about the democracy. Democratization of these countries, because it's not going to happen soon. It's not even close to soon. And we just expect all these countries to miraculously become beautiful democracies and flourishing and thriving. It's not going to happen. And what's going to happen in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of people hostile to Israel. And this hostility is going to rise. Make no mistake about it. Democracies spawn hostility in many respects. As a result,
but the president's standing up for democracy, and how can he do much other than that as an American president? But Barry, we've got your perspective loud and clear, and I appreciate it. Let me get one more from Salem, New Hampshire. Eli's calling. Eli, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yes. What do you think?
I just want to thank you for that great show. I just want to say hi to Barry, and I think I want to support him 100%. We should kill all the Palestinians, because those Palestinians, they shouldn't exist. I think he's out of his mind. God bless the president. I'm a registered Republican. I'm Lebanese-American Christian who fled Lebanon because of the Palestinian issue. I know it's going to be very hard to solve that issue, but God bless the president. If he runs again, I'm going to be one of his voters, even though I'm not his supporter. His middle name is Hussein, if I want to go deeper into him. But I'm 100% towards that solution. If we have no Palestinian, no Israel, separate state, we're going to have that issue forever. And they're sucking our blood. We support those dictators forever just to keep close eye on Israel. But enough is enough. We need that solution. We need those separate states. We need Palestine. We need Israel. So all Middle East will be breathing again.
Eli, I appreciate your call as well. Michelle Dunn, you hear there the prediction from Barry in Nashville. You know, hostility is going to rise if we have a democratic future in this region. Do you agree with that assessment?
I think that public opinion is going to be much more clearly expressed, and I think that governments, for example, the government of Egypt, are going to take public opinion into account a lot more than Mubarak did in formulating their policies. Now, how hostile is Arab public opinion, and for example, in Egypt, going to be? That really depends on what happens in the Israeli-Palestinian arena. There has been growing anger against Israel in Egypt, I would say, over the last 10 years, especially since the second Palestinian uprising, the failure of negotiating efforts. There is a certain amount of hostility there, but it really spikes at certain times. It spiked during the 2006 Lebanon War, during Operation Cast Lead that Israel did against Gaza. These are times. So it's at times like that that we're going to see strong public opinion. I do not expect Egypt to abrogate the peace treaty with Israel, nor do I expect Jordan, the other state that has a treaty with Israel,
but
to
where does
abrogate
it leave
it?
The United States, if you've got Prime Minister Netanyahu saying no very sharply to this? AIPAC, the sentiment seemed quite similar. And yet, if you've got this rising attention to public opinion, the president has made a commitment to Arab democracy. It seems like a very tough straddle, Michelle.
Well, he absolutely had to make the commitment to Arab democracy. Look, there's no use crying over spilled milk. These authoritarian leaders like Mubarak and Ben Ali, they're gone. Gaddafi's
a lot of people aren't looking at it as spilled milk.
Out.
They're calling it Arab Spring, not spilled milk.
For example, in Israel and even in Saudi Arabia as well, who wanted the United States to try to prop up these authoritarian leaders, it was never realistic to do so, and there's no no use mourning their passing, because this is just, you know, this is the way, this is reality, and this is the way that things are going. I also think, you know, Barry, one of the callers, was talking about that there was no Palestinian entity in 1967 and so forth. What President Obama was talking about in his speech is the reality of today. And the reality of today includes the fact that there is a Palestinian people, a Palestinian nation. This is recognized even by almost everyone in Israel.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the United States, Israel, and Mideast peace in the era of the Arab Spring. Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer is with us, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, joining us today from Princeton University. Michelle Dunn is with us from Washington, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, editor of the online journal Arab Reform Bulletin. Let's go to Devin in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Devin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just two quick things. One, I wanted to respond to Barry, the previous caller, as a, you know, saying that there wasn't a Palestine pre 67, so how could we negotiate or, you know, say that that should be a country? As a Palestinian American, my, you know, concern with that is that, you know, pre 48, there wasn't an Israel or a Palestine. It was a mandate of Palestine. And so, you know, my grandfather would always talk about, you know, we talk about nations, but let me take you out to my olive trees that for generations our families have been nurturing. You know, I think we have to also understand what it means that this is a post-colonial situation, and how does that impact how we even talk about, you know, recognizing who is existing.
Devin, so do you think the Arab Spring changes the parameters for this conversation, or
most
not?
Most definitely. And, you know, hearing Obama's speech, one of the things that was concerning for me was the hypocrisy in some of his statements, because, you know, everything that he quoted about what people were experiencing in the, through the Arab recent Arab uprisings from Libya to Syria to Egypt to Bahrain is that Palestinians have similar experiences for generations, and that, you know, as my question for the show would be, how does, there is a unique situation for Palestine, and that is that it's occupied. So how is it, what does this mean for the Palestinians being, how do they express their democracy when they can't really go to the polls, vote for a government that they know will be recognized?
Well, of course, they have gone to polls and they have voted. But, Ambassador Kurtzer, you hear the gist of Devin's question. As democracies rise and people exercise freedom of speech and movement and all the rest, you know, how do you see the situation of the Palestinian people in that kind of era?
Well, I would say two things to Devin. Number one, we have seen the growth of Palestinian democracy in the past decade or more, the building up of institutions of statehood, elections that were held in 2006. They were free and fair. We happen not to have liked the outcome, but they were free
and
fair.
With the
election
of Hamas, you're saying.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And now the efforts by the Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, to, in a sense, get the Palestinians ready for independence. So on the one hand, I think Palestinians, in a sense, have been precursors of the Arab Spring by showing that it's quite possible to develop institutions of statehood in a democratic context. I think second, the fact is that, you know, this is a conflict that has always been about partition. For the last 70 years, people have come up with all kinds of ideas about how to resolve it, and there has never been an alternative to having these two people share this land. And that's what it's really all about. When the president the other day talked about starting a negotiation from the 67 lines, he's talking about the partition of the land. And this goes back way before 1948 into the mandate period. So, you know, the Arab Spring is today's issue, but in a sense, we've always known how to resolve this conflict. It just requires the leadership to get us to a situation where we can resolve it.
Michelle, Ambassador Kurtzer looks at the development of democracy within the Palestinian community, and there have been those votes. But is the rest of the Arab world going to look at Palestinians and say, yes, they've got democracy? Devin looks at them and says, you know, they're up against the kind of thing that Bahrainis are up against or Egyptians a few months ago.
Well, Palestinians have attempted to have internal democracy. Even though they don't have a state, they still have internal politics. But that was short-circuited by the United States and by the international community. You mentioned the Palestinian elections of 2006, and then after those elections, which left Hamas, an organization that the United States considers to be a terrorist organization, in control of the Palestinian government, the United States led a campaign to basically strangle Palestinian democracy, to cut off funding to this government. That led to a Palestinian civil war in 2007 and a break between the West Bank and Gaza. What we saw just recently was an attempt on the two to come back together, Hamas and Fatah, the lead organ of the Palestine Liberation Organization, to come back together. I think that has been a crucial step. Palestinian political life has been cut off. President Abbas has been sitting there in the presidency long past his elected mandate. I personally think that Palestinian internal politics and ability to promote democracy is a key part of moving toward a solution with Israel. It's very difficult to have Hamas there, but one thing we have to realize is that even under the current Palestinian reconciliation agreement, Hamas and Fatah are going to form a technocratic government, and the PLO is still going to be the negotiating party with Israel. And as of now, at least, Hamas is not inside the PLO. So it's not actually the case, at least not yet, that Israel would be called upon to negotiate with Hamas.
Though Prime Minister Netanyahu is certainly bristling at even anything close to that. Let's get a call from William here. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I believe that the borders should be put back to the original 1948 borders that the UN determined was fair and right. What land was taken by war. I think that Israel is at great risk. Israel provided a democracy for the first Arabs in the land. They had Muslims had offices in the legislature. They could run for any office. They could vote. They had more freedoms than they had in Egypt or Jordan. And yet they trashed it. I think the thing about democracy is we don't know where it will lead. They may unify in democracy, and then we find out that chapters 8 and 9 of the Quran trumps peace.
But as Americans, William, how do we oppose democracy? I mean, on what grounds do you do that?
Well, it's the egg is broken, but on grounds, well, we don't have to. I think there are other options. Let me try to think of one. How about financially putting pressure so that it won't be possible for Palestinians to get arms through Gaza, which will be a possibility, probably a probability, now that Mubarak is out of power?
Yeah, maybe there's that leverage, maybe, and maybe not in this new era. William, I appreciate your call. One more right here from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Summer, you're on the air, Summer.
Hi, Tom, Michelle, and Ambassador Kurtzer. I have a question I would like an honest answer to. In President Obama's speech last week, he kept on referring to the friendship of the U.S. and Israel. And if I made a pro-con chart of Israel and the U.S. and what we get out of this friendship, I see Israel gets X billion of dollars in aid. The U.S. vetoes any human rights violation at the U.N., and basically Israel gets carte blanche to do as it pleases. But on the U.S. side, all I see is certain defense industries getting contracts, and the politicians get support from pro-Israeli lobby. But as a U.S. citizen, what am I getting from this friendship? Because I see we put ourselves more at risk, you know, with this one-sided friendship, and I would like to know what I'm getting out of it as a U.S. citizen.
Ambassador Kurtzer, may I put that to you?
Sure. We have seen this as a mutual partnership rather than as a one-way street. We do provide Israel with a substantial amount of military and economic assistance, and we have provided a great deal of political assistance to Israel as it has sought recognition and acceptance in the international community. In response, we have gotten, number one, the friendship of a democratic country, which is quite important in a world that's changing. And secondly, there are very tangible security and intelligence benefits that we derive from this relationship, many of which we don't talk about publicly because they are security and intelligence in nature, but derive from a very close cooperation, strategic cooperation that has institutionalized itself in the past 30 years. And since the Reagan administration, we've built up a series of bilateral consultations on military, intelligence, international security issues that has paid that have paid tremendous benefits for us, especially since 9/11 in the effort to curb international terrorism.
So you're saying the benefits are secret?
Well, yeah, we know what the benefits are, and when we feel protected and we benefit from not having to go to war, you know, it's the dog that doesn't bark.
But we did go to war. I mean, we went to war twice since 9/11.
Well, but these were wars of our choice. They weren't wars foisted upon us. We can have another show, Tom, on the question of whether or not it was the wise course of action. But even in these efforts, the kind of cooperation we get from an important ally like Israel have paid dividends for our national security.
Michelle Dunn, what do you say to Summer's question here? And what about the issue of U.S. interest in a time when the region is changing? This has been a strong, long-time Democratic ally. Now President Obama is saying we may see new democracies emerging here. Does that change the equation of American interest in this region? If so, how? And what about the balance?
Well, in addition to what Dan said about the strategic benefits the United States gets out of the relationship with Israel, I think we should raise, too, the moral aspect, right? The United States supported the creation of Israel, and so there's a certain moral commitment there, mm-hmm. just as there's now, I think, a moral commitment to support the growth of democracy in the region. That's, you know, it's part of who we are as Americans, that we believe in this. Now, the problem we have is there's this third moral issue, which is what about the Palestinians? What about their self-determination, their right to have a state that we have acknowledged and we said we support, and their right to have a democratic state? That's the conflict that comes in here. So I don't think it's a question of diminishing support for Israel. The problem is we've got a real difference with the current Israeli government about what kind of steps need to be taken in order to allow Palestinian rights to be realized. And also, I think we think as Americans to support Israel's stability and security going ahead. We think Israel will be more secure in a neighborhood in which the Palestinian conflict has been resolved.
And the president said as much again at AIPAC and last week, saying that commitment to Israeli security is very deep here. And yet the pushback as the United States tries to maneuver here was very tough, Ambassador Kurtzer, from Prime Minister Netanyahu. I mean, I'm reading here Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic saying, "Dear Mr. Netanyahu, please don't speak to my president that way." It seemed extraordinary, Mr. Ambassador.
Oh, it really was. And I hope the president privately said to Mr. Netanyahu that this is unacceptable behavior. We don't expect our president to treat foreign leaders the way that the president was treated by Mr. Netanyahu, almost a dressing down lecture in the Oval Office on Thursday. But we have a president who is quite expansive in his willingness to keep an open tent and to bring different views in. And therefore, I think the president's willing to persist despite this personal rancor between the two of them.
Let's get a call from Middlebury, Vermont, and Teek. Hi, Teek. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I had one question related to this Obama-Netanyahu relationship. How does Obama start to make or push Netanyahu towards accepting 1967 borders as a starting point? Do we use our economic aid as leverage, or do we just have to wait until a new government comes into power in Israel?
Michelle Dunn, what about that? What is the leverage here? If America's got a lot on the line, Israel, of course, has a lot on the line, but so does the Arab world, so do the Palestinians. What's the leverage here as we look forward? And when the president talks about 67 borders plus mutually agreed upon swaps, What does that mean about all those Israeli settlements now in the West Bank right up to the Jordan River?
Well, I want to thank Teek for asking what I think is the important question right now. President Obama has sketched out some you know, fairly strong American positions, right? Initially, he pursued a settlement freeze. Now he's talking about, you know, negotiations have to start with the 67 lines. The real weakness, though, in this administration's policy has been strategy. How do you follow up your positions and actually try to persuade the parties, if not to actually adopt our positions, at least to engage and engage in negotiations with each other based on that starting point? The administration has not been good on that. And I'm hoping that now, you know, as the president comes forward with more positions, that there's been more thinking about this than there was the last time around. Because another byproduct of this has been that we have sort of left the Palestinian leadership up a tree by taking strong positions that the Palestinians then adopt, right? They said we won't negotiate with Israel until there's a settlements freeze. Now you hear Mahmoud Abbas saying Netanyahu has to accept the 67 lines as a starting point or we won't negotiate with him. And then the United States doesn't have a well-developed strategy and ends up backing away from these positions, leaving the Palestinians sort of hanging out on a limb.
Ambassador, we've just got a minute here. What's the path you think we're on? Are the Palestinians likely to take the 67 borders baseline as shoving off point for new talks, or are we headed for exactly that vote in the UN that may leave the United States really hanging out there?
Well, Michelle Dunn is exactly right. If there's no follow-up diplomatically by the president and his national security team, this will be a very short-term initiative. It's not a surprise that we want to start negotiations on the basis of the 67 lines. The president now has to do diplomacy. We've got to make a persuasive case to the Israeli people and political system. We've got to make a persuasive case to the Palestinians. There's got to be strategy. There's got to be tactics. There's got to be follow-up.
Meanwhile, the Arab world turns and turns, at least so far, into that Arab Spring. Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, joining us today from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Thanks very much for being with us, Ambassador Kurtzer.
Thank you, Tom.
And Michelle Dunn at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, editor of the online journal Arab Reform Bulletin. Michelle, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.